Welcome to Witch Lit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Witch Lit is brought to you by Thousand Volt Press, a family-owned independent publisher established to produce the books we want to see in the world. All our titles can be purchased directly from thousandvoltpress.com or wherever you buy books. If you'd like to support Witch Lit, please consider buying us a coffee at ko-fi.com/witchlitpodcast. Casey Zabala is an artist, tarot reader, practicing witch, living mystic, and creator of the Wanderer's Tarot and the Weird Sisters Oracle. She also hosts the Modern Witches podcast. Her latest work is as editor of A Confluence of Witches, a modern witches anthology, which is out in October 2024 from Red Whale Weiser. With 17 years of tarot experience, she has a studied and intuitive approach to her readings while incorporating elements of natural magic and manifestation techniques. Casey is the founder of the Modern Witches Confluence, an educational gathering of modern witches sharing their wisdom and craft. She lives in the San Francisco Bay Area. Casey Zabala, welcome to Witch Lit.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
I'm excited to talk to you about all that you've got going on. But our first question for everybody is, why write? So in this, like, you know, weird mix we're in of social media and sound bites, why still write books or edit them or do any of that?
I do feel like it's an activity of sort of soul making or meaning making. Writing is a way of affirming one's existence. And it's a way of also pushing the boundaries of our existence. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, for me personally, why I write. It's ranged from being therapeutic and healing to being a channeling exercise, so a spiritual practice, to really feeding a creative urge that I have. So I believe it can do so much for us as humans.
Yeah, no, I agree. Like there's so many elements besides the creative aspect of it, I think. Mm-hmm. But you're also an artist. Mm-hmm. So how do you weave those things together? Were you a writer first? Were you artist first? Were you one of those people who just decided that all people are writers and artists and didn't get the whack on the head when you were a kid that says, oh no, only creatives get to do this stuff?
I do think I was lucky in that I had a mother who worked in the arts, mm-hmm. who worked for artists, promoting artists and supporting their work. So I was really encouraged to be artistic from an early age, and I'm really grateful for that. Mm-hmm. I think that writing and art have always been entwined for me. I've always been drawn to sort of the visual element of writing. I'm a notebook and paper and ink kind of gal still to this day. So there's something for me that's very like tactile and visual about writing. That's very somatic. So the two for me are just like so related and always have been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that is lucky. And yeah, my mom was a painter, mm-hmm. and also got that. I got that same, like, everybody can draw, you know, like just do it, you know, and a few art classes here and there. So yeah, I appreciate that. And though I do not consider myself an artist, I do appreciate that, that encouragement. Like, I feel like we, you know, I can't remember where it's from, but the anecdote about, you know, like if you go into a kindergarten classroom and ask them who can sing and everybody raises their hand, and who can draw and everybody raises their hand, and then you do it with a classroom of high school seniors and you might get two. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you know, why do we, you know, that to me, being able to recapture that is part of being creative, I think, or not having lost it. Maybe, I don't know.
Totally. I think it's also, it makes me think of just believing in everything is magic, or that we are all magic innately, or we're all intuitive. Yeah. Very similar. It's like, these are just human avenues of being a human, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You don't have to be special to do them.
Yeah. No, and I think that's such a conversation, especially in like the witchcraft and occult community, about and I never really know what it arises from, this idea of being like an innate witch. And I'm like, aren't we all? I mean, yeah. Like the magic is there. It's in us, in our molecules. It's not something separate.
Totally. I know. I think there's something about, you know, being ordained or initiated that, like, I understand tradition and lineage. And I also think there are ways that it can be very gatekeepy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for me, one of the reasons why I love witchcraft so much is that it's this like non-hierarchical, fundamentally, I believe, inclusive practice.
Yeah. You don't have to have someone else come in and tell you you're a witch.
Right.
You claim it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think that's partly, it's interesting to me because I do think, you know, with creative endeavors like writing, like, you know, visual art, you know, there's this tendency for most creatives I know to have some form of imposter syndrome. Because I do think we have this cultural thing about you have to be validated in your creativity in some way. You have to be published. You have to have a show, you know, whatever. And I'm like, that's not how it works.
Totally.
I mean, sometimes I have to tell myself that's not how it works.
Oh, yes.
But
I fully agree. I think it's, you know, we've been trained to have something to show for it, or mm-hmm. like be fixated on the final product. Mm-hmm. Or even that validation piece, more so than the process of like actually becoming a great tarot reader or having like a spiritual practice that grounds mm-hmm. us, or right, like writing a book or whatever mm-hmm. it might be. So yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot lately myself, just in a period of my life when so much is shifting and like really relishing in not having an idea of what the final destination is and just being in the process of whatever is unfolding, which is really hard.
Yeah.
But interesting.
Yeah. Being in the moment seems like a constant effort sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're talking, for folks who are listening, obviously we're not talking in January because your book hasn't come out yet. Mm-hmm. We're talking in August. Happy birth month, by the way.
Thank you.
But I kind of wanted to ask, like, as a writer, like, was putting this book together and as an editor and kind of curating that, was that process really different for you?
Yes, definitely. I think, you know, when you're writing, you are in control of the variables, right? Like, you mm-hmm. are the one who's producing the work. And as an editor, and especially not as a self-editor, as an editor for someone else's work, there's a lot of research and space and honoring of another person's voice and perspective that comes into play. And it was a really good exercise for me, I think, just to be a space holder. Like mm-hmm. I think a lot of people who in ritual just hold the space, like hold a container really well. And it felt like that type of practice in a written sense of mm-hmm. how do I create and set up a container for all of these really diverse pieces of writing to come together and sing together, create harmony. So it was really, really fun for me. I thoroughly enjoyed the process and I hope I get to do more of it in the future.
Nice. So how did this project, how did A Witch's Confluence come together for you?
So I've been hosting the Witch's Confluence, which is a sort of a symposium for magical folks since 2018. And my favorite part about the work that I do with that is the curation aspect and bringing together so many different voices and amazing teachers. And I was really excited by the opportunity to create something that felt more archival. More of a snapshot of what radical witches are thinking about and experiencing right now in 2024. So it took a long time to kind of push myself to actually do it. I think, mm-hmm. you know, doing the curation piece and getting authors to participate. That's a lot of work on its own, just like coordinating. But it came together really beautifully, and so many people were so excited to be a part of it. And I was just really excited to already be connected with Wiser Books at the time, and they were super excited about the project. So it flowed really naturally.
Nice.
Yeah.
So speaking of being connected with Wiser, so your first two projects with them are a tarot deck and an oracle deck. And mm-hmm. I wanted, you know, though we primarily talk to authors, we've had a lot of tarot deck creator folks on the show too. And I love the aspect of creating a tarot deck as weaving meaning and image together. Mm. And you also, you know, depending on decks, like sometimes there's an artist and a writer for the, or kind of like a, it is a lot like editing, I think, in a way, when you have a writer who's doing the book and then an artist who's doing the cards. But you are both in these cases. So what was that process like for you to have that both things going on at the same time, besides it being a ton of work, I'm sure?
Right. Totally. I think that really speaks to kind of my creative practice. I think I was sort of trained as an artist to write about my art, mm-hmm. Either through like a personal statement or even just through like having a rigorous research project that is constantly like humming along behind the scenes of any creative project. So having loved tarot decks for a very long time, like it felt just like such a natural outlet for me, something that was a research-based creative practice that I could like also explore through writing. I ended up, I think, with a Wanderer's Tarot. When I was creating that deck, I had a notebook of research, and I was writing about each card at the same time as I was drawing. Mm-hmm. So when I went to kind of compile the guidebook, it was almost like I had done a lot of this work already, and it was more just an editing project of stringing everything together. And with Weird Sisters, that was much more, such a creative project with an oracle deck where there's that lack of structure or mm-hmm. maybe history and lineage behind it. And it was really a conversation with a host of like spirit guides and really, again, like creating like a container for the deck to come through.
So Wiser very graciously sent me a copy of the Weird Sisters deck. So I've been working with it. And initially, one of the things that for folks who haven't seen it, do you want to describe it a little bit? Because I feel like it's kind of a unique setup, even for an oracle deck. Like it's just be like kind of the sections you have in the deck. And then this, I've described it to someone else as it's almost Matisse-like, the curlicues and the, like, it's, you see the spell being woven on the card, I guess is the way I describe it.
That's very kind.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. So the deck itself is broken into spell cards, candle cards, tool cards, and sigils. Mm-hmm. And then we have the three Weird Sisters as sort of like these guardian spirits in the deck as well. And so when you're using the deck, you are sort of asking for advice, but the deck is giving you that validation and guidance, but it's also prompting you to incorporate that into your craft in some way, like go use this sigil in a certain way, or create your own sigil, or light a candle, say a prayer, whatever it might be. And those prompts are purposefully sort of like loose for folks to bring their own creativity to it, their own witchcraft. And something that I was kind of surprised by in the creation process of this deck is that I have this sort of like spirit language, which I think is what you're referring to, the mm-hmm. curlicues, that has been something that I have been writing in for a long time, like since I was a teenager. And it's just sort of something that flows through for me. And it wanted to be on the deck. So it was really lovely to be able to kind of incorporate that into the spells, sort of my own sigils in the background, and the spirits who sort of have been a part of my own creative process for a long time. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's one of my favorite things about the deck. And it's funny because when I first looked at it, they seemed more organic and random. And then the longer I've looked at it, the more you can see things in it, I guess, which is why I think I've described it as like being able to actually see the spell on the card.
Nice.
But no, I've really enjoyed working with it. And I think, you know, just as I guess end user sounds very cold and technical, but as someone working with the deck, I guess, I love that it's like, especially on days when it's just like you want to connect and your brain just can't engage that way or whatever. It is just like a little nudge, like just do this thing and see if that helps or whatever. Yeah. Like it's a very gentle deck in that way, which I really like.
So. Thank you. Yeah, I do think that it functions in a way of just like nudging you to try something simple. I think. And that's, I think, speaks to where my magic comes from. I think like elaborate ceremony is fantastic when you have dedicated time and space and energy, but so many of us don't have that a lot of the time. So I think it's important to remember and realize that like magic can be really small and can exist in your mundane reality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's really important to you. I do think we get caught up in this idea that, you know, you need like a full blown ritual and, you know, hours of time to do things when sometimes it's as simple as, like you said, like lighting a candle or being mindful when you have your tea or, you know, those things can be big magic in their own ways.
So. Totally.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So I guess I often ask people like if they have a ritual around writing, but I feel like you as a writer and an artist may have different things. Do you approach work differently when you're writing versus when you're creating art?
That's a good question. I feel like it does shift depending on what I'm working on, but I think I get a lot of my inspiration for my creative projects through my writing. And I do a lot of automatic writing. So my routine generally is to have sort of like a ritualized routine to write every day. And then from there, oftentimes images will start to come through. Sometimes I'll be writing and all of a sudden I see imagery as well. So it kind of will naturally feed into that. And right now I'm working more with painting, which I haven't done in a long time, on canvases rather than paper and watercolor. So yeah, it's nice to set up my creative practice in a ritual setting that feels bigger for me, just like in terms of like canvas or size. And I find that it just takes a little bit more preparation for me to like set the space, light the candle. I also really like to listen to certain things when I'm painting. So it's like whale sounds are like one of my favorite things to kind of get me into that creative rhythm. And also just like music is a big part of my practice too. And putting me in that space that feels maybe more liminal.
Yeah. That kind of ties into another question I had. Like, I think, you know, creatively, sometimes it's easy, especially when you're like working on a specific project, like for publication or something, it's easy to like burn yourself out a little bit on because you have a deadline, you know, there's a different aspect to it in that way. So if and when that happens to you, like, what do you do to like feed that well if you're tapped?
I do like to switch mediums. Like if I'm feeling tapped and like stuck writing, I do like to find a way to like doodle, draw, paint. I think there's something there. It's like, okay, I need to like shift the way that I am thinking about this thing. And I typically find that if I'm able to do that, something loosens up, because I feel like I get really tight in those moments when like I feel stuck or like drained even. So yeah, switching mediums or exploring in a new medium sort of just gets the creative flow moving for me.
I like that. And I do think that it's one of those things I find interesting, and especially just the people I've talked to on the show and other people I know, who are creatives in their, I guess, in their vocation, is that generally, even if it's not something they do like productivity wise, like they're not publishing or exhibiting or whatever, it seems like so many creatives I know have more than one channel for that. And I wonder if that's part of it, if it's that idea that, it has to come out some way. So, what else can I do when I'm stuck in this one piece? I've just talked to a lot of people who, who are authors and musicians or dancers, or, they paint or they do crafts or they knit. There's always something else kind of bubbling. Or, like I joke often that, a lot of times, especially when I'm writing fiction, my best ideas will come in the shower when my mind is quiet. And I have a friend who knits, and she's like, it's when she's knitting because her mind is
Knitting.
quiet.
Yeah, there's something about that, like, I don't know, the repetition piece or something you've done for a long time that I feel like unlocks something. I always think about, I'm pretty sure it was Einstein who would sit with marbles in his hands and like nap almost, or like go into like a REM state with these marbles in his hand, sitting in a chair. And once he was relaxed enough where like one of the marbles would fall from his hand and hit the floor, like that's when he would have unlocked something or have some kind of realization. He was a very magical guy, I think.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I mean, Einstein's one of those people, like definitely a complicated person. But it's so funny to me is when I was a kid, he was so exalted as a science person, a science mind. And the older I've gotten and the more I learn about him and people talk about him, you realize that he was kind of a mystic too.
Totally. Yeah, I definitely think so.
Which again, I don't think is that odd to me. I think to be a scientist of that, astrophysics and like advanced math and all that, you kind of have to want to know how the world works or how the universe works. And that is kind of a mystical endeavor, even if you're coming at it from a scientific perspective.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's something larger at play, right? There's some big existential questions behind all of that math and science.
I don't think you figure out how to discover the mysteries of dark matter if you're not interested in how the universe works.
Yeah, agreed.
That's a leap. That's a bit of a leap. I guess to kind of talk about that, about mysticism and that. So how did you come to your path?
I think I've always just been deeply curious about what is holding us all together here, what keeps things moving forward, or moving back in time and things happening simultaneously. And I was raised in a Catholic household and I was taken to church. And I remember sitting in this huge building and not understanding anything that was going on, but like being so fixated on the images of Mary and being like, who is this woman? Like, what is she doing here? And why is she important? And why is nobody really like talking about her? I feel like that was a big entry point for me. And I was also a really avid dreamer as a kid. And I would have predictive prophetic dreams as a kid. And everyone told me that I was crazy, you know, and not to be, they're just dreams, you know? So that side of me that I felt was so real and knew was really real for me, was being invalidated. But then it wasn't until I discovered tarot and divination where this thing that was supposed to be just a material object was like validating my spiritual experiences, mm-hmm. that I realized something, there was something here, right? Like there was a whole world that was validating to my personal experience as a spiritual person. So once I found tarot, I sort of like really went off the deep end and read all the books I could read. Have always been really curious about religion, studied Buddhism and all sorts of different religions. And I think witchcraft was something that once I started to, like, I remember going to my first like formal witchcraft class with Reclaiming Collective and just having this moment of like, wow. So like, people do this thing and have names for these things that I have been doing already, mm-hmm. and had no language for. So it was a huge awakening moment for me. Just been sort of feeding my curiosity with self-study, and also through school, through my creative projects. So.
So when you dived in to read all those tarot books, who were the people that resonated for you?
I definitely am a huge Mary Kay Greer fan. Rachel Pollack. I studied a lot of like Paul Foster Case's work as well early on. I was really fascinated with that. The sort of Kabbalistic framework was fascinating to me, mm-hmm. From an early on learner, I think because of just the layers, mm-hmm. in the tarot, and in the symbolism. I think at this stage in my tarot journey, I have more of a nuanced approach to like using Kabbalah and understanding what that is. But when I examined that and my fascination early on with it, I think it was like the multidimensional reality of all of these symbols being layered into this deck. It was just, mm-hmm. like so fantastic and enticing to me. And I still feel like something that I find so beautiful about tarot in particular as a system is just how incredible the archetypes are and how they show sort of like the multivalent and multidimensional quality of these archetypes and how they show up in the world. So yeah. Yeah. Later, I would say like Benabel Wen has been a huge influence, and still learning. Yeah. There's some amazing tarot books coming out right now that I'm super excited about.
I've been fortunate to interview some folks and Benabel too, who is lovely. I feel like there's a lot of pretty groundbreaking, revolutionary tarot books coming out right now that it's really fascinating and really looking at the tarot as a tool for revolution almost, which yes. I love. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's some great stuff coming out right now. And I love that idea of always being a student of your passion. Like, I think that's how we continue to be interesting.
Totally.
As people and mm-hmm. interested in, you know, interesting as people and interested in the world is to, what is that? Always be a beginner.
Yes.
In some ways. So
beginner's mind is a deeply important concept for me.
Yeah.
I do think the thing that about the tarot that's so cool is that it's just going to keep expanding with our human consciousness. Mm-hmm. So it's exciting to see where it'll go.
Yeah. So I guess kind of in that, one of the things that I'm fascinated about tarot is how I'm sitting here looking at this giant stack of cards on the edge of my desk, or boxes of cards, but like just the constant reinterpretation through other people's experience of working with it and whatever else their niche hobby is. But I wanted to ask you, like, when you discovered the tarot, where did you start? Like, did you start with a Rider-Waite-Smith deck, or, you know, and how has your thoughts about, like, the art of tarot evolved over time?
Mm. So my first tarot deck was the Aquarian Tarot. And then I moved on to the Rider-Waite and the Thoth deck as well. Mm-hmm. I think that, I mean, there's so much about, like, the canon of tarot that was defined during that Golden Dawn, Aleister Crowley Splinter time,
mm-hmm.
That I find, like, historically fascinating as someone mm-hmm. who, like, studies that lineage. And is constantly, like, being like, this is interesting. Do I like this? Do I not like this? And being critical of those choices and what mm-hmm. went into those decks. But I think that ultimately it is based in these universal archetypes mm-hmm. that are meant to be changing and evolving with us. And I'm really grateful for all the artists out there, like, bringing representation to the world of tarot.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a deeply important piece of being a modern witch now, is, like, pushing our tools to evolve with us and our diversity and the way we show up in the world. So yeah, I don't know. I think that there is such a, like, an explosion, and as a lover of art as well, I'm just, like, super excited as someone who just moved and is also sitting next to, like, a physical box of tarot
yeah.
decks.
Yeah.
It's always so exciting to just mm-hmm. to realize, like, oh, this deck is the deck for me this month or this week or today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just, like, yeah, being able to, like, have that deep connection with different artists through the work they put out is, like, so special.
Yeah. Yeah, I just, it's so easy to become a collector by accident or on
yes.
purpose.
Yeah.
And, but it's funny to me, like, how I do love tarot decks, and I will continue to love them, but I have to say, like, I'm really kind of leaned more and more into oracle decks.
Mm.
And I think it's that, it's kind of feels like that, like you were talking about the expansion, like, it's so interesting to me, like, you know, your, the Weird Sisters deck, the organization of it is so different. Like, sometimes an oracle deck can feel like a box of sigils
mm-hmm.
or very simply symbols. Like, one of the decks that I love to use is the Secret Pocket Oracle, the mm-hmm. little tiny cards
yeah,
with just,
so sweet.
You know, like a single image on them. And it's different to me, like, how they trigger. And as you work with tarot or oracle decks, they take on the meaning, your own meanings. Like, at some point you can, you know, toss the little white book over your head and go, no, I disagree with them on this. I know they drew it, but I think this is what it means for me.
Totally.
Yeah, which I think is it's just interesting to see how, like, over time working with a deck, how it changes. So.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's such a deeply fascinating spiritual dynamic that's happening. As a deck creator myself, it's like I consciously work with the spirits that are inherent in the archetypes and my own spirit team to bring the images through. And then your spirit guides and your spirit team are also interacting with those archetypes mm-hmm. and your higher self is saying, this is the message. So it's just like, I think sometimes folks can collapse, like, oh, this is the card and this is what it says in the book, so this is what it is. When there's really a deep level of spiritual communion and communication mm-hmm. happening, that I think is really almost beyond our human comprehension. That's why
yeah.
we're also fascinated with it, right?
Yeah. Do you have, I mean, obviously your own decks, but do you have a favorite deck you work with right now? It's like asking, like, which is your favorite cat or child?
It's so
yeah.
hard. But it's interesting because I have been in the process of moving, and the deck that I was using in the lead up to my move was the Angel Tarot. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I don't have one, but I have seen artwork from it.
It's very vintagey looking. Yeah. I don't know. There's something that's like, it's almost Marseille adjacent that was calling my name. And the deck that I'm using now, having been settled, is one of my favorites, which is the Daughter of the Moon deck, which is a round deck, feminist deck from like the 80s, I believe. Yes,
I have a copy of that, actually.
Yeah, one of my favorites.
Yeah. That one, it's so funny. I recently, because I had the deck, but I didn't have the booklet. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, maybe I'll just buy the booklet online. And it was like $100. It was insane.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Apparently the decks are also worth quite a lot too, because they've been out of print for a while.
Mm-hmm. We should take their mind better.
Yeah. So I went through, and like on archive.net, you can check it out, you know, for an hour check out the book for an hour. And so I was reading through and kind of copying down some stuff from it. And it was so interesting to me about how not having the book and how I connected with the deck and things I'd noticed from it, and then reading the book. And though I think the book is really good, it also is definitely of its time. Yes. In the 80s. There's definitely, I think our shift as feminists and as people in general has shifted a lot from when this deck came out. But the imagery is still so powerful. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to me how a deck ages in that way.
Totally. I think a lot about that when I work with the Thoth deck as well. Mm. Just because Aleister Crowley was an extremely controversial and problematic figure. But Lady Frieda Harris was such a visionary artist. Mm-hmm. And while I've studied some of like Crowley's teachings and work, just to kind of get some bearings there, like I think what speaks to me so much is the artist and mm-hmm. their work and their contribution there.
Yeah.
But it is really complex and nuanced. And I think especially like kind of like what I was referring to earlier, when what I find really important when I talk about divination and talk about using tarot, it's like, this is a spiritual tool and there are spirits encoded into this work, and divination literally means speaking to gods. Mm-hmm. So coming to that work from a place of being grounded and rooted in one's own spiritual support system and acknowledging the energies that exist in the decks and sort of saying a prayer to ask for the guidance that you specifically want to be in tune with or in conversation with, mm-hmm. that feels really important to me. So as to like, oh, right, I'm not intentionally connecting with these outdated tropes of femininity, mm-hmm. for instance, or exclusionary dynamics in old feminine circles. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I feel like there's ways to connect and honor the artwork and the archetypes in ways that are safe or maybe protected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think that deck too, I mean, what they were doing at the time was pretty groundbreaking.
Right.
Because I think about that deck and the Mother Peace tarot mm-hmm. kind of in the same breath a lot, because there are similar in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. But I mean, just the one of the things reading the book is that the different ways they spell women, like throughout the book,
yes.
there's many different spellings of woman or women. And, I just always find that kind of funny now, because I feel like we've really stepped away from that. And mm-hmm. it is a little, sometimes a lot, essentialist that mm-hmm. is difficult to kind of reconcile. But then you look at the card and it's not, like you said, it's not really in the archetype of the card. It's in the interpretation of the person who's writing about that, mm-hmm. which I think is pretty interesting. Because it was, I mean, I think it was spearheaded, and her name has fallen out of my head.
I think it's Fiona Morgan.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
Like, I think she spearheaded the project, but there were a lot of contributors, both in the artwork and in writing the book. So I think that's pretty interesting. Even down to like who they quote in the book, there's a lot of Merlin Stone and Barbara Walker, and a lot of people who've kind of not really been, I think, you know, a lot of stuff is foundational about what they were doing, but we've come to a different understanding of things since their work.
We've evolved massively, for sure. Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know, as someone who is a writer and also the artist of my decks, I do like, from my standpoint, it feels like that would be hard to not do both for me personally as a creative person. And I'm fascinated by that level of collaboration. And I know there's some amazing collaborative decks coming out. I know, I forget what it's called, but I know Adrienne Marie Brown contributed.
I just did the Kickstarter.
So, I mean, I think like there's just this new wave of revolution coming through to sort of like sweep up and update so much of what was. So,
I can't remember who, if it was on the show or if it was just a conversation I had, which is a bad place to be in your brain. but we were talking about the fact that you can't just, you know, change the color of someone's skin in a Rider-Waite deck image and make that inclusive.
Yes.
It has to be bigger than that because of context. And so I really appreciate the people that are doing that work and really, like you said, making inclusive decks and representational decks that are just more real to the world we live in, you know, like it isn't all based on, you know, European spiritual thought or, you know, imagery, symbolism, all of that. Like I think it's so important to me as a witch. I can't speak and I won't speak for everyone, but to remember that we're all on the same planet.
Absolutely. And that, I don't know. I think so much of like occultism is in dire need of some like upgrade in terms of understanding that diversity piece. And also understanding the roots of a lot of Western occultism come from pretty problematic places. I think there's a lot of like education that I feel like has been done really broadly in witchcraft spaces and magical spaces. And I'm excited to see us like moving beyond some of the basics, I guess, and moving into more complex, nuanced territory, which I think witches are uniquely suited to navigate.
Yeah, I do love that there seems to be a bigger conversation around, like you said, examining the roots of where so much comes from. I mean, because people like Aleister Crowley's, you know, handprints are all over modern practice, it's good to know where that came from. And I think a lot, I've been doing a lot of research for the book I'm working on, and it's like, you know, there's, you know, it's Crowley and Blavatsky and these people who had interesting ideas and have spawned things that I think were bigger than them in a lot of ways, whether their personalities overshine that or not.
Yes.
But they're complicated people. They were complex people with faults and, like you said, in some very problematic ways of thinking and being in the world. But, you know, how do we, I always think about it as like, weirdly, like people who do vintage dressing, like vintage clothes. It's like, yes, I love the clothes from the 50s, but I don't want the values. You know, it's like, I appreciate that you can look at, like you said, like Crowley's work. And then like, what is the piece to take away? Realize the context it came in. How does that apply, you know, in current thought, witchcraft practice? And where do we go from here? Like, how do we address that if it's a problem? Or how do we go, yeah, he was right, but he wasn't right about everything. You know, he might have been right about this thing, but everything else, you know, kind of can put that aside. So I think it's interesting. And I don't know, as I've gotten, you know, one of my, I guess maybe it was hitting 40 and now 50. Like, I want to know these things. Like, I've been so much more interested in the history and the foundations of where things come from. And sometimes when you go digging, you find things you don't want to know, right? Yeah. But I think it's important. I think you're right. I think it's important.
And I think it's important to acknowledge that, you know, especially like as a white person, there's so much in my lineage that is horrific and, you know, unquestionably terrible. And I can't just like disavow that, you know, it's not about just saying like throw everything
that's
away.
That's not me. I didn't do those things.
Right. Yeah. It's like actually, it's like owning those things as part of who I am today and making choices to find the good, honor the good, and move forward in ways that are radically different than my ancestors. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, that's like the healing work that I believe we are meant to be doing at any, who, no matter who you are. It's like, okay, we have a choice right now. We have a lot of information, so much more than anyone ever has. It's like, what are we going to do with that information that's so important?
Yeah. And I think, you know, there is this tendency in witchcraft and occult circles to say the older it is, the better it is, which I don't agree with.
Yeah.
And many, for a lot of the reasons you just said, it's like, but I also think it takes away the agency of the people living now when you prioritize things that are thousands of years old over what we've learned since then.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think it's interesting. Like, I've been doing a lot of ancestral lineage healing work with Daniel Four, who is an amazing resource for this type of work. And, you know, you go back to like a certain four generations back is like how, where you start. And it's like, there's always, you can always go further back, right? But it's like, the things that you know now that you are in control of, that you can heal and have awareness over, are so deeply important. So like, I think the tendency is to go way back, it's like, sure, like we can tune into the pre-patriarchal energy of our ancestors, and we should, that's meaningful. And we also have to acknowledge that we are going to have to face all of the damage and the hard stuff. You know, we don't just get to take the love and light, or however you want to cage it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, exactly. Oh, I feel like, you know, I can talk about this for a really long time. Yeah. It's just so fascinating to me. And it's such a big part of my work right now. And I think that's why I feel like a lot of these conversations I've been having come back to this. But
here for it. Definitely.
Yeah,
here for
definitely.
It.
Definitely. But I do want, you know, to kind of honor your time and listeners' time. So I wanted to give, before we do our little game of chance question at the end, I wanted to give you an opportunity to kind of tell folks how to find out more about your work or what you've got coming up. Like I said, this will air the first week of January. So
awesome. Yeah. I mean, I think all of what we were just talking about really feeds into the anthology that I edited that is coming out, A Confluence of Witches. This is an anthology that really grapples with ancestral healing, the diverse practices of witchcraft, and how to be a witch in the world in reverence and in awe for the diversity of our experience, for our collective and personal traumas. So it gets into the nitty-gritty of things. And I think all of our authors, whether they're discussing, you know, practices of working with the moon, or healing with plants, all of them are touching on the roots of like needing to be real with ourselves and do the shadow work. So it's a revolutionary project, and our contributors are incredible. We have 20 contributors in the anthology. So it's really robust. And that's coming out in October, Confluence of Witches. Mm-hmm. You can also follow me on Substack. My Substack is called Hedge Spells. That's where I'm sharing more writing And hopefully sharing more of a future project that I am in the research stages of. So very excited to be sort of like using Substack as a way to connect with people and also to just, share more of my work in progress, which feels kind of vulnerable, but also exciting as mm-hmm. a creative person.
Yeah.
I'm also on Instagram. I don't know why. It's at Wanderers Tarot. I'm not really having a good time on there right now. But you can find me there. I'm also at Witches Confluence on Instagram. And our website is modernwitches.org. And that's where you can find all of the information about our upcoming event, I guess, that'll have happened. So
yeah. So you'll already be planning for 2025 when exactly. this comes out. Yeah.
So come find us. We do have a Patreon, and I run monthly coven circles where we kind of just connect about our witchcraft practice, and we have themes, and we usually do a little divination work, spell work together.
Awesome. And yeah, I'll make sure to put links for all that in the show notes for people.
Awesome.
Hard to remember all that if you're driving or out for your walk while you listen.
Thank you.
Yeah. So our last question for everybody is kind of my way to, be very Scorpio person and ask people like questions about stuff we're not supposed to talk about. So I'm going to roll a die. And depending on what number I get, you'll get a question about death, sex, religion, politics, or money. All those big things.
Mm-hmm.
And if I roll a 6, you get to pick which one you want. You can also skip if you say, I don't want to talk about that. So 1, death.
All right.
You're in. Yeah. We didn't really touch on this at all. So, one of the things that I have been thinking about in my officially middle age, although I always joke, being middle aged at 50 means that I would live to be 100, which is great. I mean, it can happen, right?
Why not?
So for you as a witch and an intuitive and an artist and all of your practice, how do you feel like that has changed or shaped your relationship with death in kind of contrast to like our overculture of very much hiding death and being afraid of it?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think witchcraft is one of those systems of belief that really embraces death as an integral part of why we're here, who we are. I think about death a lot in general, but also I think about it in terms of like the cyclical process of our being.
Mm-hmm.
I think about the process of like little deaths that we have in our cycles, whether it be paying attention to like the balsamic moon and really thinking about like, what am I like composting? What am I releasing right now? What am I letting go of? What needs to die in my life right now, whether it's a belief, a relationship, a pattern, so that I can move forward a little lighter and with more space to evolve. I think in that way, I do think about death a lot, and it helps me organize my life because I know that I cannot just keep on the linear track of accumulation and progress, like that myth that is extremely capitalistic and patriarchal is so impossible to me
mm-hmm.
as someone who lives with an awareness of death and cyclical living. So I think it really functions in the way I do my business too, where it's like, okay, I might not make as much money this quarter because I cannot physically do all of the intuitive work that I have been doing, and sort of saying like, I know where I need to have a little death or a little release in order to regenerate again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, I like that. And I don't know that, you know, my personal work has made me like completely unafraid of death. I think it's part of the human condition to be trepidatious about the unknown.
Mm.
And there are things we just can't know, right? But, you know, having built a system of beliefs and all of that, like you said, and really thinking of death as a cycle, I do feel like it does become easier to not be frantic about it. Because I do think there, you know, it can, that fear of death can drive us to do more with the time we're given in positive ways and negative ways.
True.
So, true. So I think having that relationship is different. And I feel like, I don't know, and I think this is still a process that's evolving. And I'm curious if you see this too. I feel like the conversations since COVID have changed around death for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Like I just hear different things.
Yeah, I was just also thinking, because COVID, you know, it's here, it's not going away. And I think it's morphed into all these shape-shifty things, but it was that great pause that we all had, which was terrible for so many of us. And then for so many of us, it was like surprisingly an opportunity to see life differently. And it just functioned in so many ways. So many of us were touched by death, by COVID. And I think it forced us to grapple with grief on a collective level. And some of us like chose to opt out of that completely. So I want to acknowledge that too. It's not like everyone had this awakening. But I do think COVID is, even as it comes into our day-to-day life of like, oh, you get COVID, you have to say no, you have to cut the cord, you have to like go and retreat. There's something about the virus that to me on a spiritual level feels like a real reckoning of you are immortal. You can't do whatever you want. I don't know.
Yeah. And even on like a bigger level, like I think about, you know, it's a reckoning about with the stuff we saw with supply chains and all of that, like it seems like a reckoning on like a cultural level too of this is not really sustainable in a world where, you know, you just produce and produce and produce and then not really think about where that goes or what all that happens. And I think, you know, just how, like you said, it's changed a lot of people that has really changed them, either because they've had COVID and experienced that and what that's like and what it means. And, you know, or they've lost somebody to COVID and realized that this is kind of a new reality for a lot of people. But yeah, I don't know. It's all very interesting to me. I think it's still very much evolving, but it's interesting. I don't always want people to just look at something spiritually because there are practical things about events like this.
Yeah.
But I do think it can give you some perspective to look at it, like you said, from a spiritual, you know, what is the deeper meaning, or not, you know, silver lining it or anything like that, but what can we learn from this?
Totally. Yeah. I think like also sometimes, especially for me as a witch, I feel like when I talk about the spiritual lining of things, it can be dark and negative and be spiritual at the same time. Yeah. Like those things can exist at once. And I think New Age culture has done a big disservice to spiritual folks, of like stripping away the shadow.
Yeah.
It's like a real important teacher. I don't know. I think COVID and this period of time, it's obviously going to keep evolving, and we're living through climate collapse. Like there's a level of I don't want to say comfort, but confrontation with death that I think we all are reckoning with in our own personal ways, in our communities. So I'm really hoping that this will also come with increased opportunities for community grieving, community support, and mutual aid during times of loss. So,
I definitely think that is the way we survive this.
Mm-hmm.
So,
just shout out the work of Joanna Macy. The Great Turning is a really brilliant framework for folks who are like really wanting to attune to maybe death or like being in a cyclical relationship with what's mm-hmm. going on.
Yeah. I'll make sure to put a note about that in the show notes too. But yeah, well, Casey, thank you so much. This has been such an amazing conversation and I've really enjoyed meeting you and learning more about your work, and I'm excited for what's coming.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this as well.
Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shenekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram or Threads at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. And thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.